Hello and welcome to a truly extraordinary episode of the Offside Musings podcast. My name is Oke Ndibe, and I'm here with my co-host Emeka Onyagwa. I said that today's episode is extraordinary, and I really mean it. We have a guest who is part of our occasional series on civil liberties in Nigeria. And the guest is somebody who has played a truly outstanding and important, continues to play an important role in the civil liberties space in Nigeria. And that guest is Clement Nwankwo. And those of you who have had more than a few years' sense of civil liberties in Nigeria, would of course recognize Clement. But for those of you who don't, I'm going to give a very, very sort of minuscule introduction. And then Clement is going to tell us a lot of the story of his involvement in this space momentarily. So Clement Nwankwo is Executive Director of Policy and Legal Advocacy Center, PLAC, and a well-known as well as well-respected Nigerian lawyer with very wide experience of the Nigerian political environment, extensive contacts within the political, diplomatic, media, and civil society communities. His good knowledge and understanding of the Nigerian legislature, leadership, and staff, as well as the intricate legislative processes in Nigeria. Nwankwo has had deep involvement in the founding of the modern Nigerian civil society movement. He created the idea of and co-founded Nigeria's first human rights group in 1987, the Civil Liberties Organization. He also founded and led for several years between 1990 and 2003 the Constitutional Rights Project, CRP, a leading Nigerian human rights group. Mr. Nwankwo was also founding convener of the Nigeria Civil Society Situation Room and also founding chairman of the Transition Monitoring Group. This, as I said, is simply a sliver of the breadth and width of the role that Clement Nwankwo has played in the civil liberties space. I'd like to add that I've known Clement and I've counted him as a friend from his days in university. And so Clement is such a delight on behalf of my co-host Emeka Onyagwa to welcome you to today's episode of the Offside Musings podcast. Welcome.
Thank you,
Welcome.
Kay. Thank you, Emeka. I am honored to be on this podcast. I'm delighted to speak.
Good. So would like to start. You've indicated that again today is a very busy day for you, so we're going to just, and we have like an elephant field full of questions to ask. So let's begin by inviting you to tell the story. A lot of people, even those who know about the Civil Liberties Organization, CLO, which was the signal organization fighting for civil liberties in Nigeria in the era of military rule, under especially a general, General Ibrahim Babangida and Buhari's regimes. A lot of people know of the CLO, but they don't quite know of the genesis of it. And I do know that you were central to its founding, that in a lot of ways you were the originating spirit. So could you, in a kind of handkerchief way, give us a bit of that story? What was the motivation? Where did the idea come from? And how did you ultimately put together the nucleus of his first leadership and membership?
Thank you. Thank you, Kay. That's a very great question. And I feel, again, especially on being invited to participate in the conversation. I think that when I look back to 1987, this is several years ago, quite amazed at the trajectory of evolution of the civil society movement in Nigeria. In 1987, when the idea of the civil liberties organization came to my mind, there weren't any organized human rights organizations. We didn't used to call it civil society, we called it simply human rights organization. It meant that in 1987, there were no precedents, so to say, to set up a human rights organization. I had just finished youth service in Ijebu, present day of the state. And while serving in Ijebu, I had to deal with a lot of cases. I worked with the Legal Aid Council, which was a government agency. But as a youth service member, we call ourselves youth coppers. As a youth copper, you allow to represent people in courts, except for what was described as simple offenses. And simple offenses simply meant maybe assault or such type offenses where you never got the penalty of going to jail. But when I went to Ijebu and I had to visit the prisons in Ijebu to talk to prisoners, and Legal Aid Council required that I do enter the prisons, that I interview the prisoners, identify the cases, and then I would be advised as to which senior lawyers existed in the town that would take on those cases. And I remember being assigned to work from the office of one of those senior lawyers. And then when I took on some of those cases and brought it to his attention, he said, "Well, you go to court and get a date for hearing." And on one of these occasions, I went to court to get a date for hearing, and the judge was quite upset with me and said, "Are you a lawyer?" I said, "Oh, yes, I'm a lawyer, but I only just became a lawyer a few months ago." I said, "Well, you know about being a lawyer a few months old. You have a case before you, a lawyer, you've got to take on the case." And this was a case of murder,
Wow.
which we were not allowed to take on, but the judge insisted. This prisoner had been in prison for more than 12 years, and the judge said, "Look, I want to get done with this case. Because if this person committed the offense, then I want to know. I want the evidence to come on. But if he hasn't, then I don't want the courts to be another reason for his continued detention." So I was completely at loss, and a senior lawyer who was in court said to me, "Why didn't you apply for adjournment?" And the judge overheard that and said, "Okay, you want adjournment? I give you adjournment. Come back in 2 weeks." And then I went back and I spoke to the lawyer who was supposed to be handling the case, and he said, "Look, he doesn't have the time. You've got to go and deal with this." So 2 weeks, I was back in court, and the judge said, "Are you ready?" I said, "I'm not sure." The judge said, "Well, you've got to go with your case." So the case started, and first of all, it's the prosecution that has to present evidence. And the prosecution had, I think, just one witness. Incidentally, he was a police officer, but he wasn't the police officer that investigated the case. He just simply presented his summary of it. And then there were people, other witnesses, who said yes, that they saw this person. They accused the suspect, and the evidences were taken all in one day. And the judge asked me at the end of it, "What did I want to do?" And I said, "Do I have any witnesses?" And I asked the suspect, and he said, "No, he has no witnesses." And the judge said, "What do I want to do?" So I requested another judge to come back and continue the case. And I had to go back, review what had been presented, spoke with a couple of senior lawyers, and they said, "Well, look, you've got to buy time. And buying time means that you have to enter a no case submission," which was what I did. When I went back to court, I entered a no case submission and stated that First of all, the policeman who arrested, no longer available, he didn't come to testify. All of these eyewitnesses did not actually see. They are only speaking on the basis of rumors and suspicion, but no direct evidence. And after the judge listened to me, I had to go back to my law school textbooks to read how to enter a no-case prosecution. And after the judge listened to me, he reserved judgment, came back subsequently, and decided that I was right, that there was no sufficient evidence laid out to justify conviction. So I won my first case, and as a lawyer, if you won your first case, as the most serious case anybody can be charged with, which is murder, then you become a celebrity. And I became a celebrity within the confines of the detention facility, because there were so many other people who were charged for murder. And I found out, and this is without going on to too many tales, that there were so many people charged for very serious offenses, murder, manslaughter, assault, occasioning harm, and so on. And I took on a lot of these cases, recorded victory from it. When I left Ijebode back to Lagos, to live in Lagos, I found that the demand was so high. And then some of these suspects who had relations in other prisons in Lagos, so I gave up my information, and those who were calling me, and I was going to employee prisons in Lagos, the maximum security prisons. I'm taking on these cases at no cost to these suspects. And when it became overwhelming, I decided that I couldn't do this alone, and that's how now try to find lawyers who would join me to create an organization. The only thing that I know closest to an organization was when I was in the university running what was called a philanthropic organization that was founded by a friend of mine, Dr. Ernest Ugo, who was a doctor in the media, and you know him quite well. That was the closest I knew.
We were very close. And that's how we came to know each other.
We came to know each other. Yes. So I went to a friend. I went to someone who had been introduced to me, a lawyer. I said to him, you know, I would like to have him join to take this idea forward. And he said, look, I don't have time. But if you are prepared to you know, run it, then I'm happy to join you. So that was how I created the Civil Liberties Organization. In fact, I named it Civil Liberties Organization because as I was sitting in front of him, the question was, what do we name it? And Ulisa looked back at the shelf and saw a book that said Civil Liberties. I think it was some book about civil liberties in America. And then he said, why don't you call it Civil Liberties Organization? And that's how the CLO started in October of 1987.
Wow.
So you guys got to operate a lot during the military regime of especially during late Babangida's era eventually into Abacha's era, which was very famous or infamous, depends on which side of the spectrum you choose to be on. very famous for brutality, bombings, assassinations, and so on and so and you know, so on. And you as a civil liberties organization, you clearly were handling a lot of cases that the government would have deemed you maybe even persona non grata. So it's very interesting. We would like to know, what was your day-to-day life like, given that picture that you were operating under in the early to mid phases of your of the creation of the civil liberties organization?
Those were difficult days because immediately we started taking on these cases on a very large scale. In fact, one of the early cases we took after the CLO was founded was a case involving asking the courts to order the closure of Ikoyi and Kirikiri prisons because they were unfit for human habitation. This case won exceedingly great national and international attention. We also took on a case to close a detention facility that was located in the Atlantic Ocean, known as Italco Island.
And that's right.
Came the base here because, again, we couldn't say that we achieved anything without courageous activist journalists like Okeh Ndebele. He was in Concord, he was in the African Guardian magazine, I think.
Yes.
And did a lot to help to publicize our activity. And I think that without those engagements, certainly very activist journalists at the time, the attention we got, but we took on those cases, asking for closure of Etel Island, which was a political detention island, created under the military regime. It forced the administration to close the prisons. We began to build links with international organizations like Amnesty International, Human Rights Watch, and so on. We began to write reports of the human rights situation in Nigeria, publishing reports on the human rights situation in Nigeria. Indeed, in 1988, we published a report on the human rights. In 1989, we published the report on the human rights situation in the country. We invited the founder of Amnesty International, Peter Benenson, to Nigeria. And this gathered a lot of attention, for which myself and Odisha were detained by the authorities and held for 5 days. So certainly, yes, there were repercussions for the things that we were doing. What was incredibly great was the fact that Nigerians became aware of the very severe human rights situation in the country. Like I said, we had allies in the media, Okeh Ndebele, Nana Ogan, several others who were quite active in the media, who supported us. I think that, that really was a huge success in terms of helping more organizations emerged. I wouldn't say that we're the first activists. That's certainly not correct. They were very accomplished, well-known voices. Ghani Farahimi, Beko Ransom, Uti, Akabashon, Komin Shola Oshobu, several Nigerian lawyers and others who were very outspoken. Fela Nicola Kokuti, one of my biggest heroes in terms of icons, in terms of music, and also music with message. These were people who joined in the movement, either formally or informally, to create, I would say, a major human rights institution in the country that gave rise to the explosion we see today of civil society.
Yes. So, Clement, I remember a few years ago during the Obasanjo regime, I happened to be in Port Harcourt speaking at a university. And a bunch of students came to me and said that when they saw my name announced as one of the speakers at this conference, that they thought I would be too afraid to show up. Because this was a time when I was particularly unforgiven in my blistering attack on the Obasanjo regime. And so they said to me, what is it that sustains you, or what is it that insulates you from fear? And it was a question that I hadn't considered, because I'm by nature a very fearful person, right? I'm fearful of mosquitoes, for example. You know, if I see one mosquito in a room, I'll be so unsettled, you know. So how was I able to take on a regime under which so several people have been assassinated, and including journalists, right? But in a moment, perhaps, of not giving it much rational consideration, I said to the students, fear is a choice. And I've chosen not to fear. Okay. So you, somebody like you, you took on something that is quite extraordinary. I mean, you've named people like Ghani Farahimi, Beko Ransom Kuti, Fela Anikulapo Kuti, and you know, you and I were close to these figures as well. And always when I looked at them, I always felt, what is it in their constitution that shields them from this paralyzing fear, which is what, you know, when you talk to Nigerians, when you talk to a lot of Nigerians, you get a sense that they are very, very upset about the climate of the country, about the missed roads and opportunities, the abuses of life and processes in the country. But most people ultimately choose an easier life, right? So what is it? Can you tell us something, perhaps in your experience, in your growing up, in your intellectual development, perhaps even in observing people like Gani in your youth and Fela and so on? What is it that sort of shaped you into diving into this cauldron of struggle?
Well, I think in some ways, association with some of these people as well, and association with colleagues who had the same vision for Nigeria, in some ways helps to rub off and strengthen one's courage. I think you might say that even at the beginning, some of us were reckless. We didn't care about ourselves.
Yes.
I grew up seeing Nigeria as a possibly great country. I read history in the secondary school. I read government. I left secondary school and I worked in an area close to the Afabelewa Square. In fact, in Afabelewa Square itself. And I would take a break from work to go to the National Assembly sitting and watching proceedings when the National Assembly was at Afabelewa Square in Lagos. And I listened to several legislators in the National Assembly. And you could see in that National Assembly then the patriotism of several of the people who were in that room. And for me, the aspiration to see Nigeria become great was burning in my heart. And reading through history, the struggles of early nationalists for me remained a resonated continuously. When I finished at law school, a very close friend of mine, again, okay, you know him, Dr. Ernest, was arrested by the military regime. For me, that was one of the most annoying situations. Why was he arrested? He was in a contest with orthodox medical doctors.
Conventional doctors, yes, orthodox, yes. Over the test tube baby case.
Test tube baby claim that he made, and he was detained. And at the end of the day, what was he charged for? For owning a telex machine. For me, seeing that level of injustice was really, really very telling. And so I wouldn't say that I am fearless. I wouldn't describe myself as such. I think that when I see injustice, I react in a way that seeks to confront it, because at that stage, I feel anybody could be in that situation where they are victims of injustice. I've had to be waiting at a diplomat's house, and I tell this story all the time because it tells you how bad and dangerous it was. The Canadian High Commissioner was having lunch for myself, Dr. Becker, and some Kuti, and a few colleagues in his house. We were waiting to begin lunch when we got the news that one of those who was to join us at lunch had just been shot and killed on her way to attend lunch with us. This was in 1984. Kudirat Abiola, wife of MPO Abiola,
You mean 1994, not 84.
Yes. So for me, again, these sort of incidents, rather than create fear, create anger. And you really want to confront people who perpetrate this level of injustice. So I wouldn't say I'm fearless again, I say that, but I just think that injustice stirs a lot of anger in me, and I think that one then prepares whatever the consequences are to try to fight back against injustice.
Yes.
I mean, given all you've said, it's very interesting to imagine what it was like then to be able to raise a team of lawyers, journalists, professionals who were committed to fighting for civil liberties. And, you know, it's hard for some of us to look at Nigeria today and imagine that you could even raise anybody whatsoever. I mean, the Nigeria of today, I don't think you would even manage. So, you know, I think maybe there was more courage then, or it's just maybe in the last 30 years plus, the whole generation of Nigerians are even less willing to go down this road. So it's very interesting how the circumstances and everything, the challenges you faced then, and even till now, and how you see it right now in terms of raising people to fight for civil liberties, as you've been doing for a long time.
Yeah, certainly. I think that the lines then was very well drawn. I would say it was black and white. It was, you were either fighting for democracy or you were with the dictators. I think today the lines are very blurred. There is some kind of dubious democracy that exists in Nigeria today, whereby some sort of elections, you know, happens. And suppose representatives of people representing the people. Civil society has gotten soft or softened by democracy. Mm-hmm. You are told that you have not been elected. In those days, yes, we knew we were not elected, but we knew that people stood behind us. Today, the politics has been mixed up by ethnicity, by poverty, by religion, and so on. So it's a little bit difficult today to be, you know, clearly black or white, because the taint of politics and tribalism, let me not say ethnicity, and religion is quite stark today. So I really wouldn't blame the current generation. I think that the circumstances are different. In those days, if we had to have a meeting, if I had to get a message across to any of our colleague activists, I would send people physically to go find them. I wouldn't pick a phone or send a text. You know, we've been able to speak in this forum within a couple of hours of trying to get it together. In those days, mm-hmm. if you needed to speak to someone in Kano, you probably need to send someone physically to go to Kano. So communications are so different, circumstances are so different, and again, we've been softened by democracy, dubious democracy. Mm-hmm.
Yes. So you'd spoke about the report that you wrote chronicling human rights abuses and your invitation of the president of Amnesty International to come. And so there was a certain use of the media. Then there were cases that you filed in court and so on. But can you describe sort of in a kind of global sense the strategies that the CLO adopted in highlighting or in pursuing this fight to reclaim human rights for Nigerians? What were the various strategies that you had to adopt?
Yeah, that first report, I wish I had it on my table here, but I'll do a screenshot of it and send it to you.
Please.
That first report highlighted the severe conditions under which people live in the prisons, the challenges of the media, how journalists were beaten, arrested, and detained, the circumscription of press freedom, and all sorts of abuses that existed with the human rights situation at the time. And we thought to highlight these things. When we highlight them in the reports that we issue, or put out press statements. Like I said, the relationship between the media and the early human rights movement was really, really very, very good. And, you know, when I say journalists, somehow I feel that it's actually not the appropriate title for the work that the journalists did at the time. These were activists as well, who from their different media houses were doing incredibly much. Okay, you were in African Concord as well. You yes. know the kind of report that African Concord put out.
Mm-hmm.
We took a boat from the shores of Atlantic mm-hmm. Ocean and rode 4 hours into the Atlantic Ocean to find the Taupo Island. We had a journalist with us, Amal Gan, who I think she was news editor of The Guardian on Sunday then.
The Guardian newspaper, yes.
Yes, The Guardian newspaper, which was one of the most respected newspapers. And, you know, we came back from that report. Stories were written. The world was shocked because this was a story that was published even in the New York Times. At that time, to get a mention in the New York Times, not to talk of getting almost half a page on page 3 of New York Times, which was what that story is taught, was exceedingly striking. I think that the alliance that we built with the media, the ability to communicate with citizens, the alliances we built with the diplomatic community, the use of the African charter in pursuing cases in court, because in a lot of the cases we did, or a lot of the reports we put out, we backed that up by using the courts as well. So the courts, in some ways, even though they still were weak, judges were still frightened of the military dictatorship, we could still use the courts as a forum for creating awareness, and in some cases, rare cases, getting what we call bold judges to make decisions that or pronouncements that were reverberated. So the strategies were multifaceted, and I think that the impact was huge, not just in Nigeria, but across the African continent.
Good. Yeah, it's given what you've said, it'll be interesting to find out what you would say were your breakthrough cases, your most satisfying cases, your most challenging cases, your most unexpected cases. What cases, generally, given all these things, would you say stand out for you over this year long and very, very productive and very inspiring career doing civil liberties?
I think there were cases that were quite striking, and I can cite quite a few.
No, very... One of them was... okay, sorry. I thought you said you said you didn't hear the question, so I was going to repeat it again.
No, I did hear right. you. I said that the cases were quite striking. One of the main cases that we took on, which reverberated again across the continent, arose from what was called the Zango-Cassette crisis, where there yes. was an ethnic fight between the Kataps. You know, Kalamachi Kuka comes from that area.
Yes.
There was a crisis between the natives of the area in Kataf and what was called the Fulani settlers. It was a military regime headed by a Fulani, General Ibrahim Babangida. And the military government reacted by arresting the leaders of the minority indigenous, the majority indigenous group, because the Fulanis were actually minorities in the area.
Mm-hmm.
The leader of that group was Major General Zamani Lekot, a military officer. He was arrested along with 11 other colleagues of his and were charged before what was called the Civil Disturbances Tribunal. And they were sentenced to death. I took on that case. I never knew who General Zamani Lekot was. I took on that case. I filed a case at the African Commission on Human and People's Rights. We got the African Commission on Human and People's Rights to halt the execution of General Zamani Lekot because he was going to be executed. Based on what the African Commission decided, we went to the High Court in Lagos, and the High Court made an order affirming the order of the African Commission on Human and People's Rights to halt the execution of General Zamani Laport. That case was striking. This was in 1995, and it halted the execution of General Zamani Laport. We also tried to do that the following year, because the following year, Ken Saro-Wiwa, the environmental activist, was arrested again for what they call inciting, for murder actually, and inciting violence. He was, a special tribunal was set up. I was one of the lawyers who attended that tribunal. Unfortunately, he was convicted by this tribunal that was very unjust and very unfair. And all of the Ogoni people involved in that, leaders of what was called the Movement for the Survival of Ogoni People, also were convicted, except for the vice president at the time, who was not convicted. And they were sentenced to death and were going to be executed. We went to the African Commission on People, on Human and People's Rights. The commission asked the Nigerian government to halt the execution. We again went to the High Court in Lagos to try to get the court to affirm the decision of the African Commission. Unfortunately, before the court could hear the case, the Nigerian government hurriedly executed Ken Saro-Wiwa and his colleagues. And for us, that was really, really a sad day for Nigeria. Of course, the consequences of Ken Saro-Wiwa's execution again reverberated across the world, and it was one of the reasons Nigeria was suspended from the Commonwealth. And I remembered being in different capitals across the world, canvassing for sanctions against Nigeria. A lot of countries imposed sanctions on Nigeria. Canada was one of the most outstanding support that Nigeria had. Canada even had to close its mission in Nigeria on account of the killing of Ken Saro-Wiwa. The only leader of Warsaw that survived that trial was the Vice President Ledu Mite, who is alive today. But certainly, I think that there were just so many things that we did. On Italco Island, the detention island, we went to court and got the court to order the closure of Italco Island. The court made that order. The island was, the Italco was closed down by the government as a result of the reports that we put out. There were individual cases that we took on of persons in various violations of human rights, in various victims of human rights abuse that the court gave us victory on. Not counting those ones, but certainly I think that there was a lot done in that period of beginning of human rights activism in the country.
It's interesting. I'd like to sort of ask a follow-up question on the Taiko Island prison. I was just in South Africa in Cape Town and had the opportunity to go to Robben Island, again, an island in the middle of the ocean, where for some time Nelson Mandela and a bunch of his fellow freedom fighters were incarcerated. So it's interesting because these are moments, horrific moments in Nigerian history that are not widely known, that Nigeria replicated, had its own version of the Robben Island prison. Could you speak to which regime actually set up the prison facility in the middle of the ocean?
On the Taoko case, we had received a complaint, and it was Professor Wole Soyinka de Nobel-Loret who had sent a letter that was sent to him, smuggled to him from the island by someone who incidentally was an Egba man from Abeokuta. He was a teacher there at Polytechnic in Abeokuta, and he had managed to send this letter to Wole Soyinka. And Wole Soyinka had sent a letter to us saying, please could you intervene in this matter? Wole Soyinka was the patron of the CLO. And so that's what motivated our going there. Like you, I have been to the Robben Island. I was there more than 20 years ago. I think that the comparison does not exist. Robben Island was where Nelson Mandela was. He went to school there. He got a degree in Robben Island. This fashion has no comparison with the original. This was a facility set up with no indication or no intention to reform anybody, no intention to hold someone in any particular rehabilitating, and I wouldn't call Robben Island a rehabilitating prison. That would not be to do. But certainly, the facilities in Robben Island would make Robben Island look like a five-star detention facility when you
an Ivy League university.
Exactly.
Yes.
The news broke. Olusegun Obasanjo said he set up the Itaoko Island in 1977, and that he set it up because there were too many street criminals on the streets of Lagos. And so when they get arrested, they throw them in there. Nobody cares about them. Nobody knows what happens to them. I don't know if any of them who went there did come out alive. I think we don't know what would have happened to this polytechnic lecturer. His name was Bayo. I don't remember his other name. But no one knows what would have happened to him if that letter did not get to Professor Wole Soyinka. So there's no comparison between Itaoko and Robben Island at all.
By the way, was the lecturer at the Polytechnic ever released?
Yes, he was released. Once we put out the story, once we went to court, he was released. When he was released, he came. We had to find some sort of way of getting him back to his family in Abeokuta. He was really, really very grateful. We didn't see him after that incident. I think the fear, I'm trying to find the right word, but he certainly
the trauma
just disappeared. The trauma, that's the word, of that experience was too much for him to trust anybody around him. And he said to us, "Look, people died and were thrown into the sea. No families could reach anybody. Of course, then there were no telephones. So even the prison officials didn't have lived like the prisoners themselves. So the conditions were extremely inhumane and dehumanizing. For anyone to have thought to set up such a prison, it's really part of the shock of the experiences that we had or have had the civil rights movement.
Yeah, it's wild. I mean, it's breathtaking in the opposite direction. Let's put it that way. So, in essence, you operated, and this is one of my favorite things about that era. You operated in this era where anybody who expressed any kind of certain kinds of ideals that ran contrary to those in power would be chased around. And you had a bunch of publications. Specifically, you had the Newswatch, where Dilegiwa was a part of. You had a whole bunch of them who were consistent in putting out information and getting shut down. A lot of them, most people don't understand, operated as ghost operations. You didn't I mean, the government didn't know where they were publishing from most of the time. They just appeared on the streets. I think sometime in the mid to late nights, that's when I started consuming mass media. And I was a very avid reader of Tempo, Newswatch, Tell. People ask me, how do I know all these things? Which book should they read? Prior to maybe some of these newer generation of historical books on Nigeria, some people telling their own stories in slanted views, and some people trying to do a good job in telling a very, very compelling stories. Prior to that, I tell people, if you can, if you have a university that has a good library system, especially that archive a lot of African these things. I know somebody right now, and they are trying to archive even today's newspapers, especially because of NSAS, which will come soon. But I tell people to go read this. And those guys were, they were like a golden era to me, a golden generation, a golden era. So it'll be interesting. It's interesting. How much did you have to work with them? How much were you involved with them? How much did you maybe feed off of them? If you were not directly involved, how much did you go off of them? What role did they play in running the organization, and how you went about the work of civil liberties back in that period?
You're talking about the newspapers that were sort of
the newspapers,
you know, underground magazines.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Well, you know, we had what was called the Shomolu Media, and Shomolu was where they sell the newsprints in Lagos, and they have the printed
buses. Yes.
Most of these newspapers printed from that region. You cited some of them. The African Concord was closed down at some point because of what it was. The Guardian was closed down. Some radio stations were closed down because of what they wrote. These were people that we knew very well. Sometimes when these media houses were closed down, we took them to work for us because we just wanted to make sure they got and some income. That's the journalists in those places, including some editors as well. We contributed to the printing of some of these papers because they were not, you know, it's one of the most amazing things that these journalists were not concerned about their safety, about their livelihood, or anything. The passion was incredible. So some of us had to contribute monies for some of this media to print. Tempo, Tell, some of the finest journalists you can think of, and you know, I could mention their names. Some people might be shocked.
The news.
Some of those journalists who today have a different, people don't quite understand what they did because of the sort of orientation and the sort of way that they are seen now. But they a lot of them were real great heroes. Losai Giabo was in Tell magazine. Bayon Oluga was in the news. Several people that you can mention. I think left at some point, but these were people who basically put their lives on the line and contributed to the democracy that Nigeria or the return to civilian rule in 1999. I'm sure you can come to ask that question later, but you know, it's something I can say right away that we had not seen that democracy give the desired results. And some of us disappointed with where we are today, I would say very, very disappointed, given the struggles that we went through.
Yes. So, for me personally, one of the most frustrating things is to discover what I call a gap in historical consciousness in Nigeria, where from day to day, people think that everything is new, right? So when the NSAS movement happened, the young people who were in it, a lot of them imagined that this was the first time there was any kind of major formidable struggle in Nigeria, and so we're the pioneers of struggle, you see. Of course, they have, a lot of them, no sense of the CLO and the role that the CLO played, no sense of a moment in Nigerian history when the Nigerian Medical Association, the Nigerian Bar Association, NANS and so on, the students' movement was very vibrant and vital and confronting a military regime that was brutal in a way that, you know, kids living under a quasi-democratic arrangement cannot even begin to fathom. And so if some of the young ones today don't even have a sense of the CLO and the MBA, the Gani Fawahimi, Bekoh Ransom Kuti, and so on, and that iteration of the struggle, right? How can they even begin to understand the Abang Women's movement? You know, of course, the British called it a riot, you know, Abang Women's riot or the Abeokuta Women's riot. But this was, these were political resistance movements led by women. So in what way do you think that the fight for change in Nigeria is hobbled by the absence of this historical sense of the continuity of the struggles, sense that this thing has been happening over time, and so that it's not today, we're not just discovering a fight today. How do you feel that this absence of historical consciousness is affecting the struggle for change and transformation in Nigeria?
Yeah, I think it's part of the destruction of Nigeria's civic society, that civics was discontinued. Teaching of history was discontinued in school until just about 2 or 3 years ago. In fact, until 2 years ago, history had been removed from the curriculum of teaching in secondary schools and in schools in Nigeria. Yet, that's if you are to build a great country, if you are to build citizens with patriotism, with passion for country, then they must know where the country is coming from. I think that a lot of young people don't have that. I'm still struggling to finish writing the book of my involvement in creating the human rights movement in Nigeria. So I take some blame in not being able to complete that book. But I think it's time for historians to begin to write the books in the right context. I think when I listen, again, I go back to my music icon, Fela Adekunle, talks about River Niger, talks about the fact that they did not discover River Niger, that the white person came here and saw River Niger. So I think in a lot of ways, when we allow others to write the history, then we don't get the truth being said. And I think that also, you know, when I was growing up, history was my favorite subject. I loved to read history, not just Nigerian history, but world history. And I think that in some ways we need to get our younger people to begin to understand the essence of reading and reading history as well, so that they can understand the context. And I think that the fact that we do have a new world, defined by technology, mobile phones, the internet, and so on, means that a lot of the education and information younger people are getting today is information that is coming from the internet. It's not very sophisticated. It's fast and quick, and the depth is not necessarily there. So I think that impacts on the way that young people perceive of how they can respond to the question of history. But yes, the NSAS movement happened. A lot of us who knew what was going on, because there were lots of protests that we organized. Our colleague Odisa Agbakobag got a black eye from being on the streets during military regime demonstrating against the military government. Generals Ibrahim Babangida and Sani Abacha. A lot of young people did not even see such recent history as something to ask questions about. when some of us try to make suggestions about how these matters have happened in the past and what lessons need to be taken, I think in some ways we're told that this is a digital age and this is a digital protest and all of that. And it's still the same brutality of the military that suppresses that demonstration. It was the same dictator, General Buhari, whom we confronted in the 80s that was in power during the ENSAS movement. The brutality and sheer wickedness of response of states was clearly manifested again. So I think there's a lot to learn, and young people need to be able to study some bit of history to understand this.
Mm-hmm. By the way, Emeka, quickly, I'd like to do a follow-up. As you were telling the story of your involvement in this human rights struggles in Nigeria, one of the questions I was going to ask you was, when are you going to write your book to detail this? Because this is a debt that you owe to us, who are of your generation and who knew you when all of this was happening, but also of young people who need to have these historical connections made, right? So I want you to look our viewers in the eye and make a commitment that next year, perhaps before the middle of next year, you're going to have the manuscript ready and that you send it to me for... you know, to confirm to everybody that you finished it. So you know, look us in the eye and make that commitment.
One of the things that I didn't take advantage of was my proximity to you when I had you very nearby. To learn the arts of when you used to craft your wife in those days. We had it for fun, yeah. And didn't understand that we should have been taking lessons from you. I do have one script. I have been able to to read it over again. I can commit to you that over the next couple of months, we'll read that one script again to see even some of the conversations we had in that, not in that manuscript.
Yes.
So sometimes it's a question, what do you put in, what do you not put in?
Yes,
I don't
yes.
want to put out or publish a volume of book that is more than the complete works of Shakespeare. So in some ways for me, I think being able to keep it compact and easy to read is something that I really want to achieve. Since you've mentioned it, I would be privileged to send you a manuscript to give me a sense of what you think of it.
Please.
That would be a special honor for me.
Oh my gosh, that would be an honor for me. Yeah. So Emeka, you're a witness.
Yes, I look forward to it.
And Emeka is a history buff, by the way.
Doing my graduate studies in history.
Yes.
So please put it out there. Post-colonial West Africa. Well, colonial, actually.
Yes.
West Africa. But anyway, when my own publications come out, but yours has to come out first before I get to it's interesting. You've been talking about this era. And I'm always particularly, I agree with those of you in this area. We've had Mr. Richard Mr. Richard Akinola, and he echoed the same sentiments in terms of the way people don't know how to put that era in context so much. And it's very interesting. So coming into this era, how would you, if we take it from that era into this era, you've also echoed the same sentiments. I think to quote him, which I agree with, that it's a lot easier to, I really sincerely believe you are right too. Both of you have the same analysis. It's a lot easier to tackle a one-headed monster than this 9,000-headed monster of democracy that we have today.
Yeah. You know?
So it's a lot easier in that regard. But outside, well, in addition to that, what would you say are the, in you know, from the last 20 years to now, what would you say are the major civil rights problems facing Nigeria, the Nigerian space today, but whether it's even here or even in diaspora, but I actually think it is more in Nigeria. I think the diaspora most times are maybe the worst friends of Nigeria, in my opinion. But anyway, so what would you say are the major problems in from the last 20 years till now facing civil liberties in Nigeria?
I think in some ways you have had state infiltration of what is today being referred to as civic space, the human rights movement. The state has infiltrated deeply by creating its own organization, using even the media to further constrict the space, using laws to circumscribe the human rights movement. There's a whole new regime of what is called compliance. And that compliance is set up various regulatory machineries to compel civil society to become better circumscribed. I think that that's a major, major concern. The state has also been able to use the same tools of information that processes and to you, whether it is the social media, Twitter, Facebook, to constitute an attack against the human rights movement. So you see states sponsoring several tweets and messages to attack organizations that they feel threatened by. The state would have what they call a media center. They would be able to set up several media Twitter handles, for instance. Someone can own up to 1,000 Twitter handles. Why, when Twitter said that people have to pay $20 a year to be registered, I said maybe I could help to reduce the number of handles that individuals working in the state can create. So I think with all of that, it still has been able to muzzle a lot of the work that civil society does. And I think that that is a major concern at this time. Of course, the usual problems exist of circumscribing the media, using regulatory measures to curb the media, using regulatory measures to ensure that the compliance that they seek to enforce in the media space is such that controls the media. So there's quite a lot of that. The prison conditions may have improved very slightly, but still there are lots of people who are held in prison awaiting trial, which should not be the case. The wheels of justice are grinding even much more slowly now. The courts are slow. Judges, sometimes victims of the shrinking of civic space, judges are closely monitored. Some perhaps are even co-opted by government. And so in a lot of ways, it is important that you can say that you can go to the courts and get justice, especially if the judges sitting over there, judges who are under severe pressure from the state. So all of the problems of human rights exist. Of course, we did have the NSAS protests. The government committed that it was going to try to address the issues, but I can tell you that the police has not improved. The abuses, the excessive abuse by police remains uncontained. So the problems of the human rights system remains severe.
Okay, so so you're currently the executive director of the Policy and Legal Advocacy Center, PLAC. Could you describe the work, sort of in some kind of minutiae, the work that you do, and give us a sense of the nature of your ongoing engagement with the human rights space and advocacy in Nigeria today?
Yeah, Policy and Legal Advocacy Center, we call it PLAC, PLAC, PLAC for short. A whole lot of what we do looks at the fact that we now have a parliament, we now have a legislature consisting of the Senate and House of Representatives. These two legislative bodies make laws for the country, they hold government to account again. That's what we look at, the ramifications of their functions, lawmaking, oversight, and representation. And getting them to make the right laws or review existing laws, some of the things that we have done. And we have taken some of the laws that exist today that we feel is unjust, and back to the assembly. We have worked with them to try to get them to reform some of these laws. And instructively, interestingly, in 2020, we had the first ever review of the police act, and that's part of what PLAC was doing for several years to get the National Assembly to reform the police. Just before NSAS, the National Assembly passed a new police act for Nigeria that should, in theory, be able to bring the police back within the confines of respect for human rights. And the implementation of that law is still an issue, but it's one of the things that PLAC succeeded in doing. In 2022, we also worked with the National Assembly to get the National Assembly to pass a new electoral law for Nigeria. That law recognized the importance of improving the process of election administration in the country, including introducing the use of technology in elections. Unfortunately, we did have elections in 2023 that continues to be a disappointment to us and the electoral process. We have started again to look at what has happened during the elections, and this is another part of PLAC's work, observing elections and working together with different election observation groups to observe the elections. We did observe the elections of 2023. Our verdict was quite clear and unequivocal. It was a bad election. It lacked credibility. We made the point very clear that election observers, ourselves and others, did have what we observed from the election. That means that we have to go back to the drawing table to see how much can be done to improve the legal framework for elections. Of course, it's not just legal framework, it's also the nature of people who are appointed into the electoral commission. We did have Professor Akahiru Jega, who was the chairman of the Electoral Commission. He was there between 2010 and he resigned shortly after the 2011 elections. So, well, we didn't want tenure and he didn't want to continue. The new chairman was appointed. But certainly, I think that a lot of Nigerians are very unequivocal about their verdicts regarding the Electoral Commission. It has lost its independence, it has become subservient to the political ruling class. And what we are demanding, especially since recent state governorship elections were conducted a few weeks ago, is a complete revamp of the election management body, including how people are appointed into the election management body. You cannot have a situation where politicians appoint their relations and friends into the election management body and expect that elections to be well run. So that's a major plank that we are pursuing now. In addition to several other laws within the National Assembly, or new laws, a major concern for us, for instance, is that you have just about three women who are senators in 109 membership Senate body. We believe that Nigeria cannot continue a situation where women have no possibility of emerging in good numbers us in decision making. And that's why we're pursuing at this time what we call women reservation, seats reservation bill, which means that we have to reserve and ensure that we include some number of women that reflects the fact that the population in this country is almost equally divided between men and women. So I think this country needs to understand that we have to have some level of adequate level of women representation.
Yeah. That being said, so as we round up, we know your time is very, very valuable. So as we do round up, it's very interesting. There are a whole bunch of organizations which cover some of the things you were talking about. There are female organizations or just straight off feminist organizations out there, anti-corruption organizations, the good and the bad. There are all kinds. You've had even people in the, I remember specifically the Daniel Kanu organizations and all this kind of people. What am I talking about?
You generously asked for a batcher.
What am I talking about? Such a dubious organization, which some of them do exist today, right? So, but in terms of these organizations, do you identify any particular organizations that are crucial, that do crucial work with, the kind of intelligence and imagination that you would ascribe to or praise or point out as being vital for the Nigerian space?
Yeah, no, I'm not going to mention particular organizations, but I must say that there are a whole lot of organizations who are doing great work. You mentioned one now, certainly those organizations that are not doing progressive work I mentioned, people laugh as well. They know why they create themselves, why or how they exist. So I don't think that they are unaware of the reputation they have or do not have. But yes, there's quite a lot of organizations working in different areas, whether it is governance, anti-corruption, human rights, health, education, social justice. It's a whole range. In 1987, when we started the CNO, you could count on your two hands the organizations working in Nigeria. And I'm not counting the professional bodies like the Nigerian Medical Association, where, like I already mentioned, Bertrand Sokuti was secretary of the government. It was quite amazing. Or the Nigerian Bar Association, where people like Alao Akabashon, Ola Ajibola, and the rest of them.
Tunji Brentwaite.
Yeah, Tunji Brentwaite was an individual lawyer who was political active as well. So you had quite a lot of those types of people and organizations. But it counts the number of purposely set up human rights organizations. So they have evolved. And since then, again, more organizations have come on board. Yes, you have some who have questionable contributions to national development. And I always say that, there are quite a lot who are doing fantastic work. I always, always am amazed at how much people sacrifice.
Thank you very, very much. As a parting question, you mentioned earlier in the conversation about a moment in time when you believed in the prospect of a great Nigeria. I remember that was also my experience, that there was a time when I believed that Nigeria was going to emerge as a formidable nation, one to be reckoned with in the Committee of Nations. I'm not so sure now. So as a parting shot, could you describe where your emotions are in relation to Nigeria at the moment?
I think this country has a lot of promise. I even if it happens when we still are strong and contributing to its development.
Yeah.
I think that promise will come to happen one day. I don't know when. When you have a country with so many people, so many who are in different parts of the world, yearning to contribute to Nigeria's development, even from there, this interview is such a huge contribution by you and several other Nigerians in outside of the country. They call it diaspora, who want to make an incredible amount of contribution. I have a lot of friends, Nigerians, who live outside the country, who pray with me every day that this country can develop to the point that they can come back here and live in Nigeria. It's a dream that, you know, we wish that we wake up and see it happen. So there's a lot of promise for this country. Each time I travel out of the country, I come back and I see the level of enterprise of people, even human freedom that exists in this country. I'm not talking of absence of human rights violation, but you know, freedom of human behavior that I see in this country. It's incredible. It's something that you would not wish to give away or give up to be somewhere else. So I pray and I think that we would continue to make the
Could you stipulate one or two of such freedoms? just out of curiosity.
Out of curiosity,
because I tell people that there's a set, so I just so you know, when I was just in Nigeria for 3 weeks, and when I drive around in Nigeria, the freedom that people have to just stop by the roadside and pee, you know. So I say, whoa, you know, I can't imagine myself in America, right? It's difficult. I mean, sometimes when you are extremely pressed and you don't have a rest area to stop, right? You sort of finagle it, you know. But in Nigeria, people just stop and pee, right? And they drink pure water and they toss the plastic thing, you know. So I don't know. So I'm curious, you know, the freedoms that you talk about people having in Nigeria. What exactly do you mean?
You mentioned a few of some of those excessiveness of freedom, but you could stop on the road and buy condoms, which I don't think you can.
Oh yes, yes, yes.
In many countries, there's a yes. way you, I mean, and I don't think anybody advocates that you do that, but you can do a wrong turn at a certain point, get away
and leave to.
Actually, the policeman, one of myself in Nigerian police, you could actually ask the policeman in Nigeria not to shot instantly.
Yeah. On a lucky day.
But certainly, I think yes. that in some ways, I don't mean freedom in the sense of freedom. I mean, in some way, that, you know, attitudes a bit more relaxed here than somewhere else. So I think it's something that I haven't trained for so much anywhere else. But yes, when you go out and you see the level of development, you see the level of discipline, you see the level of responsiveness of government and citizens, then you question why is this not happening in your country? That's something we need to get to.
Okay.
Yeah. Just to piggyback off, okay.
Yes. Yeah. Emeka, please.
Just to piggyback, just a little summary of some of the things you said. I wanted you to. It's amazing that. The optimism. I understand what you're saying. I have my mother-in-law here from Nigeria now, and that level of structure in America is something that she struggles with every second. Right. So I see every time. So but it is interesting because the moment you were talking about representing Sarah Uyua I mean, it struck me because for those who don't know Sarah Weaver, and we've had this interview, we haven't delved into this. We've talked about having a nation purely, which there is no nation state in Africa. There's no real nation state in Africa, right? But we've had the idea. It seems like we've been talking about like those ideals. But what strikes me is, for those who don't know Sarah Weaver, he was one of the most anti-Igbo people out there, which was very interesting.
Oh, yes.
You represented him. You cited that by yourself. Like, this was one of the most important cases you had, and you felt very sad about it, and you were very happy with the response. So it strikes me, you know, it's very interesting. I don't get me wrong. I think I would have done the same in your shoes. It's just for you to put it in your own words. And then you also talked about Bayo Onanuga, who used to be one of the fighters of democracy, or maybe he was pretending, I don't know. Or maybe he's a different person that is there now, because from what we've seen of him.
Sorry, I didn't think Bayo Onanuga was returning. I think he was who he was. I think that we all shared those ideas at the time. I think sometimes also time motivates people's behavior. And I'm still shocked about how, for some people, ethnicity is key to their living. I was born in Lagos. Okay, you know, your family is a mixed one.
I was born in Yola, you know.
Exactly. I was born in Lagos. My mother is from Edo State. She's Asian. So for some people who have those types of backgrounds, some of your best friends could actually be people outside of your ethnic zone. You would never, ever have to condemn an ethnicity. So when you see people behave that way, then you know that they've been tempered, maybe by later experiences, or perhaps have some other music they're dancing to at the current time. Ken Sarawiwa, you know, we became very good friends. He was stopped at the airport in Lagos when we were going to Vienna for the World Conference on Human Rights. He arrived later. We spent quite a bit of time together. After the arrival from Vienna, we were actually in a meeting together called by me when I was head of the CNP. We were together at the Hilton Hotel. This was after Babangida had left office and imposed Mr. N.S. Shereto as interim head of government. CRP, we had convened a meeting where he was. People like General Ishola Williams were in that meeting. And we're talking about the future of Nigeria. He was in that meeting. He was one of the most fantastic persons you can speak with. He's always cranking you up with jokes and so on.
He was very funny. Yeah, he was a very funny man. Yeah.
The night of the coup, which was November 17, 1993, when General Abacha took over, he left that meeting and had a meeting with General Abacha. They were quite good friends.
Yes.
I don't know what that made Abacha very determined to kill him. That was, for me, one of the saddest incidents of the relationship that we went through. It was quite sad to see Ken Sarawiwa killed. I think at that time, he had become much more understanding of the evils. And I could see from conversations with him that the perception that some of us had about his ethnic bent had begun to shift in 1993. And when you look at the representation, that was in Port Harcourt during those trials. Ulisse Agbakoba was in that trial as well. There were several human rights activists of the Igbo stock who were in the tribunal joining to represent him. In a lot of ways, I think that he realized that he didn't need to be an advocate of ethnicity. And my hope is that people like Bayo Onanuga, who is now in government, comes back to the nationalist that he was when he was editor-in-chief of the News and Tempo and other magazines.
The News, yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it's good to know, because people, my own theory of Ken Saro-Wiwa was, we know he went to Government College Umahia. And people don't tend to, like, I was born in Lagos. I look at myself as a Lagosian, similar to the bone. My parents are both from Enugu, yes, 100%. But, you know, I have a different outlook. I think somebody like that going to Government College Umahia, he found it, he didn't assimilate as well and ended up bitter. He ended up holding grudges for a very long time. That's my own personal distance. I think you're 100% right. You knew him better. I think he let it go later on in his life.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, it's good to talk with people like you to hear that mm-hmm. end perspective. Absolutely. And just read what he wrote. Mm-hmm. What was the name of that work again? That book that
Company.
He wrote was just...
Okay,
yeah,
okay.
Which was... Just, yeah. No, not Bassi and Company. He had this... Well, this work that it was just... It was just anti-Igbo, and then you know when the Civil War happened during the occupation of Port Harcourt, Lieutenant Colonel Abacha, who was his friend, was the one in charge in Port Harcourt then, and he had this animus. He was part of the people who were looking for Igbo properties to seize, and it's a whole long story. It's just good to hear from you, Mr. Wanko, that at the end of his life. Which was cut short, sadly. I think it was tragic what happened to him. At the end of his life, he wasn't that man that wrote that. I can't remember the name of it. I have read a large part of that book. He wasn't the person that wrote that very, very, very discriminatory piece of work. So it's good to hear that, though.
Well, I didn't know him that well, but our mutual friend, Clement, Sidon Adinoba, happened to be extremely close to Ken Saro-Wiwa. So through Sid and I met him a few times. And during the times that I met him, the few occasions that I met him, what struck me, and I was aware of, you know, we also have to understand that during the Nigerian Civil War especially, that there were minority groups in the Southeast. And, you know, I call it the Southeast, this whole idea of the South-South. I continue to say that the South-South is just a kind of absurd Nigerian invention, South-South. The South-South is Southeast, guys, you know. So, you know, that there were small ethnic groups who felt overwhelmed by the Igbo, okay? Some of it was misconceived, but some of it is understandable. You know, it's just the same way that if you look at this country, the United States, right? A lot of African Americans who were born in this country sort of see this space as extremely racist. And yet, a lot of kids, a lot of men and women come from Nigeria, from Ghana, from Liberia. We come here and we say, whoa, great country, right? We thrive because we don't have that historical baggage. We don't feel like the white man has his boot on our necks, right? So yes, there are people like Ken Saro-Wiwa who at some point, even if you look at the politics of a very complicated man like, what's his name? Asare Dokubo, right?
Yes.
Who, you know, aligned with our man.
You know, sorry to cut you short on Dokubo. Yes, you know, yes. Dokubo, for the longest time, claimed he was Igbo.
It's precisely. So, and then suddenly, you know, so that politics is constantly shifting. But what's impressive, Clement, about what you did is that in the end, I said that it's always best for us to show ourselves to show ourselves the best version of humanity. You know, I gave a talk some years ago where I spoke about the ethics, something like the ethnicity of, or the ethics of, no, what is it? Basically, my argument was that your ethnic group does not confer any noble values on you. There are good people in any ethnic group and there are bad people. But unfortunately, too many Nigerians sort of feel like if I'm this ethnicity, I must support my group, right or wrong. And if my group is wrong, then because they are my group, then that wrongness becomes right. The toward the ethnicity of values, that's what I call it, toward the ethnicity of values. Let's aggregate around values, shared values. And that's what you did. You have a commitment to human rights. Even if your worst enemy is being denied their human rights, you come out and you fight for that worst enemy. And we can address their other shortcomings later. So it's really quite admirable. Emeka, why don't you close us out? I can't hear you actually. Hello?
I think he's
Yeah, okay,
muted.
sorry, I put myself
Okay.
on mute. Okay, can you hear me
On
now?
mute.
So
Yes.
I was listening. I was trying to look for the book, but it's been a very
Okay.
fantastic episode, and we sincerely appreciate your insights. It's been very deep. I generally love as not as I as if I just as a history person, as a history enthusiast, forget about the graduate studies, which is I get paid to do what I like. It's kind of weird.
Yeah.
But as a history enthusiast, the insights have been exciting, inspiring, very valuable, and we appreciate you coming on podcast. We hope definitely you'd find time again in future to come again at some point in time. And we look forward to that book.
Yes.
If I can have El Rufai at my back, I have a accidental public servant at my back. People passenger. I definitely will read yours cover to cover in the first 1 week. I get
Yes,
that
yes.
book for sure, for sure.
That's the inspiration I'm getting from now having
Absolutely.
been honored by you guys picking up the book before it goes out. So the book has
It
been
will be.
offered, so I'm not going to let that go off lightly.
Please.
I
Thank you
appreciate
very
it.
much. Thank you. And thank you,
Thank
Emeka, for making this conversation extremely
you.
exciting, as you said. Thank
Thank
you.
you. Thank you.
Yeah.
All right.
Bye now.
All right. Bye.
Yes.